Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are. This is Chris, and today, well, it's an interesting day. It's raining outside, so I'm doing this podcast indoors without a microphone, straight to the phone, and I hope the volume and the audio quality is exactly how it should be. Guys, when I was a kid, my dad took responsibility to bring me up the best he could. My mother passed away when I was very young. 3 years old, in fact, and my dad was in an awful state, having returned from the war and built a house himself with his bare hands, run a business, which was a little hairdressing salon in or shop in or barber, as they called it back in those days, in Devonport, Tasmania. He had three kids on his hands, including a six-month baby, me, three, and my sister, 11 or 12, who was in a complete disastrous state, having lost her mum, her best friend in the world. And my dad gave us all up for adoption, gave us out. And in those days, that was a fairly quick process. Is here, you're the godparents, take the kid. And the godparents adopted us all. And about 6 months or so after that, I assume, somewhere in that period, my dad changed his mind. He found the furthest place he could find from Devonport, Tasmania. I don't know, and my father's now passed away. I don't know how in the heck of the world in the 50s you ever found a place in that far away as he did from Devonport, Tasmania, but he bought a little business. He sold his barber shop, he sold the house, packed up our bags, and I don't have any memory of the journey from Devonport, Tasmania to the mainland in Melbourne, and then across to a place called Mildura. And Mildura is, in those days, was a, it's not now, but then in those days, it was at least a 12-hour drive by car, which was a risky drive because some of it was on single lane road, but it was the main freeway, as you would call it now, from Melbourne to Adelaide across the base of Australia. somehow, I don't know how, he got all his furniture, all his possessions, all the things that were important to him from Devonport to Mildura. It's a miracle. It's a miracle to think back. How in the heck did all that happen? Anyway, he found a derelict old shop, which was 10, 13, I think, kilometres, miles, sorry, 13 miles, which is, what is it, 26, 30K out of Mildura, on a road that led to a fishing spot, and it was an old derelict shop with a petrol pump. I think it was still part of the highway to Adelaide, so it wasn't that remote that there was no cars going past. And we sold bait worms, which we dug up ourselves and put them into tins, and we sold worms for fishermen, lines and hooks. I remember them all being assembled on the shelf, and sinkers, which my dad would make in the garage from bundles of lead, wherever he got that from. And he would make sinkers with little hooks in the sinkers that you tie the string, the line to. And then we sold tins of everything and bottles of anything you would use if you went camping. I remember this shop so well. I was, I don't know, 4 year old by this time, and it was paradise. There were lollies on the shelf in jars that you screw the lid on. There were no plastic wrappers and auto lollies back in those days. They were all sold in, as I said, in containers with screw-on lids. But the point of this story is coming to try to give you the backstory of the world that I grew up in, because there's something really important about it. You see, my dad was obviously in a state of incredible trauma He had been through the Second World War. I guess he had the resilience that most people who went to war came back with. They learned how to deal with stuff, either by the process of compartmentalizing what he'd witnessed, which in his later life resurfaced and drove him almost to insanity. The death and the mayhem that he experienced in the Second World War became most of the trigger for his dementia. He was with nothing to do and occupy himself, and his aging and his physical demise, all the stuff that he'd put in compartments and packaged away, never to be thought about again, came all back to surface, and it was horrible to watch. But courageous of my dad to actually work through it all, and he did. Even he went to Japan on a boat cruise to confront his pain, or his guilt. That would be the word. Anyway, the long and the short of this is there's a grieving man living in the wilderness in the outback. There was no house between us and Mildura, so it was just a big dust bowl. And all around us at this little shop, there were plantations, grape plantations. We weren't far from the river where I used to walk or ride my little trike, a tricycle, where Aboriginal people lived on the riverbank under tin sheds. Mildura is a relatively hot place, so it was a place that's capable of living out in the open, and the Aboriginal people lived off the land. Goodness knows how that all happened. They were my friends, and they mothered me and looked after me, and we all played together happily. There was no white-black thing, and my dad was one of the few people in the town of Mildura at that time who embraced the challenges of the Aboriginal people and would even take them in his little taxi business that he started. He would take them even into hospital and look after them when they were ill. With all this going on, our housekeeper moved in, and that was Helen. And she was Irish, and she had a daughter, and she was only single in Australia because she'd come out on a 10-pound ticket, whatever they called it, and her husband had been killed in a motorbike accident in Australia, and so she was an Irish woman with a daughter in Mildura in a pretty difficult place. So she came as our housekeeper, and at first it worked really well, but then she started to assert herself in the role of mother, and I, for one, was not interested in having another one. My sister was defiant to the point of violent, and so very quickly my sister was sent off to Melbourne to boarding school. I was beat the shit out of because I sort of took over the mantle of my sister, and my stepmother, as she soon became, took into the coddling of my younger brother. And bit by bit, my stepmother turned alcohol as a consequence of the circumstances she was in. Totally understandable. My dad had no love left in his heart. It was all 100% attached to my deceased mother. But he did have a practicality issue. He did have an issue with logistics. We needed care. We needed to get to school. We needed our clothes washed. And he was trying to run a little bait shop with a petrol pump out front and fill up the tank and fill up the kerosene and chop the firewood and make the sinkers and tin the worms. And all of this is going on. There was probably 14 hours a day work for him. And yet there were two kids left in the house. And it became a point of practicality for him to agree to marry her, which was her threat. Her threat was, you either marry me or I leave, because I need to go and find a husband and a life. So he did. And misery began for him, for her, for us, for the world. A loveless marriage, And I grew up in this environment. Now I'm coming to the point of today's podcast. When I presented myself to my dad as a creative child, like I would play cowboys and Indians, or I would build an arrow, bow and arrow in the garden, and I'd show him what I did, he always knew how to do it better. If I danced and sang a song, he would correct me. He would correct me. If I drew something on a piece of paper, he'd always show me how to do it better. His ambition was always good. His ambition was to make sure that I didn't get too big for my boots, as he would say. But the process that he was involved in was belittling. And so there was a huge element of criticism, laughter, built into his education. So it wasn't for the purpose of helping me become perfect at something, because I hadn't asked to become perfect at something. I had asked for approval, for acceptance, or for recognition that I'd made an effort. And my dad was unable to give it. He was unable to reward effort. He was unable to celebrate process. What he was always interested in is making sure I was never too big for my boots. On the same token, my younger brother, who was more frail and more vulnerable than me, my dad treated differently, and so too my stepmother. And they treated him as the potential creative one. And so he was rewarded for effort, and he was rewarded for outcome as a very young, vulnerable child compared to me. I became, therefore, a bit of a bully to my younger brother, because I was kind of like jealous of the celebration that was surrounding him. And I became antagonistic. And antagonistic means I got caught throwing rocks at cars that were passing the house. I swore at people. I set fire to the garden shed with a box of matches. Put spiders in people's beds. And I was really, really bad. And in retrospect, what I was trying to say is, look at me. I'm good too. But I became good at the wrong things. And this is the point of today. I'm now 70 plus years old. Yes, shock horror. However, I still suffer from that voice in my head that says, ridiculous, or it's not good enough. I have clients who have the same voice in their head, and that voice comes from the encouragement of the parent thinking they are good enough, but they could make it better. And my voice is, it's not good enough, you're getting too big for your boots. That's an important thing for you to hear listening to this podcast from the point of view of how you treat other people. It's a really important thing to think about when you treat other people. I have to be on guard that I have not inherited from my father this ability to belittle people in the idea that that is going to make someone better. Belittling people does not make them better. Belittling people, or making jokes or having sarcasm about them, makes them worse. Encouragement, which is the inner voice we all want to inherit or develop, is so critical, and it so happens in the first 3 years of our life. It's so critical that it's inherited from the attitude of the parent in such a way that it embeds itself. Now, it embeds itself in how we play sport. It embeds itself in how we paint a picture. It embeds itself in how we do our work. Is there a critic inside, as it has been with me for many years, in my early years? Is there a critic inside saying, you're too big for your boots? Is there a critic inside saying, no matter how good you do it, it's not going to be good enough, and someone can always do it better. I remember playing football and being in a football team at a quite high level of sport. I trained hard, but my training was my perfection, not my performance on the field. Because once I went into a performance field, the competitive nature of it and the threat of intimidation from the crowd on the outside and the other players in the field dropped me back into, under this sort of stress, dropped me back into self-preservation. And that voice came up is, you're being too big for your boots. You shouldn't even be on the field. You're not qualified. And so, look, I think it's really important to be married to this concept of an inner voice and your, the way we treat ourselves influencing strongly the way we impact other people, and make sure that we educate or re-educate or reprogram our early cognitive development, reprogram it so that we suddenly start reinforcing how people behave. We start reinforcing what they're doing right. We start recognizing process rather than criticizing or seeing what could have been or what might have been better if they had have done X, Y, Z. I always believe that the best way to do this and the ultimate way to do that is if somebody asks me for criticism or for comment or for suggestion as to how they can improve what they're doing, I think they're ready to hear it. If somebody hasn't asked me for criticism or comment or encouragement about what they're doing, they're basically saying, fuck off. Don't interfere, because they're in typically the inner voice of a person is harder on themselves than you can ever be. So if a person's beating themselves up and they're doing something and they don't know if it's good enough, they've got doubt, they've lost their confidence and all these things, and you get to say, to speak the lack of confidence or the or speak the error that they're witnessing or speak about that, it relieves them of the pressure of knowing that they're doing it. There could be improvement. It relieves them of the stress of feeling like they're inadequate and makes you the perpetrator, makes you the deliverer of negative message. And they will resent that. So we don't want to be provoking people and costing ourselves friendships and relationships and the ability to help people through life and give them love and give them kindness. We don't want to sabotage that by jumping in where angels fear to tread. We don't want to say to someone, you're too big for your boots. We want to say, your boots are perfect. You are amazing. You are a shining light. You are a wonderful, growing, evolving individual that will learn from things that take place. And the greatest teacher any human being on this planet will ever have is their inner voice, because it will firstly criticize more than anybody else in the world. It will honor themselves more than anybody else in the world. Nobody's going to do to you more or less than you do to yourself. Your job is to offer a helping hand, and if a person doesn't reach out for it, put it back in your pocket. And make sure that you haven't inherited some form of unconscious, subconscious put-down process of people's efforts. They're trying their hardest. Everybody's doing their best. Sometimes it doesn't look perfect. Sometimes you can see things they can't see. But if a person's not ready, they won't ask. That's an interesting piece of reflection. As we all want our children and the children of this earth to grow up feeling enabled, empowered, feeling that they have a voice inside their head saying, you are worthy, feeling that they have a voice inside their heart saying, you are loved, recognizing that errors are not evidence of stupidity or ignorance. Errors are the learning process to exist on this planet. And I think what we can encourage ourselves to do is to be careful where we where our energy is. This is you don't want to become what I call a joy stealer, a joy killer, and that person is in the case of my dad, that person is doing their best to bring somebody to along the journey, but doing it by a process that actually leaves a scar. All right, so that and the way we treat our kids and the way we treat our partner and the way we treat each other and the way we treat people at work, all this thing, you can't separate that out. You can't say I treat one person at work well and I treat people at home bad or vice versa. You treat people, that's your frequency, that's your energy. And that you can change, you can modify, you can improve, you can grow it. And at the ripe age as I am now, I am still on a growth path. I am still learning. I'm still evolving. I'm still doing my passion. I'm still speaking in the world. I'm still doing the thing that I said when I was, I don't know, probably around 15 years old and it all started to turn. I still am doing what I said I love to do all day, every day. So, and the process of learning in that is incredibly tough. Incredibly painful sometimes. You think you're arriving at a place, but that place slips away from you and you have to keep moving. And look, it's 50 something years of human development every single day of my life, reading books, going to workshops, psychology, studying it, dancing it, living with Indigenous people around the world. I'm still, to this very day, a beginner. This is Chris. You have a great day.